from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with the new director of the Heron School of Art and Design Gallery.
I'll take a look at the new A Craftsman's Legacy TV show seen on WFYI3.
And I'll check out Artville, a partnership between the Stutz and a gallery in Irvington. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. This fall, the Heron School of Art and Design Gallery welcomed its new director, Colin Tuis Nesbitt. Nesbitt has worked and studied across the U.S. and beyond, as Sharon Gamble learned when she invited him in for this Welcome to Town interview.
So where is home for you originally? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the metro east of St. Louis.
Oh, so you're a Midwesterner.
Yes.
So it feels like coming home to be back here
it does.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you've been kind of all over the country. You studied in Italy. How did you get on the path to art and art curation?
It was kind of by accident, I think. I'm trained. I have an MFA in printmaking and a BFA in printmaking. And I think there's one of those moments where, you know, a bunch of your friends start to get together and they're like, let's do a show.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept on being put in charge of those weird shows. And eventually that segued into another opportunity in Utah when I was there. And, from there, it just kind of kept happening on a regular basis.
So. What do you think these friends and acquaintances saw in you that made them gravitate to you as the organizer?
I think that it's something, this is kind of funny, but I think it's a cultural thing among printmakers. We're organized people that have to do things a very particular way. And so eventually that translated into, certain mediums, I think, and I won't name anyone specifically so I don't offend any of my friends here, but certain ones are a little more hippy-dippy than other mediums. You know, certain types of people gravitate toward those different types of media. And, I think a lot of printmakers in general get pulled into organizing things, and that's obviously not always true. But
there's future art school students out there making notes right now. Okay.
That's right.
Yeah, print. I need to make sure I get some printmaking under my belt.
Exactly.
And as you studied fine art, how did you choose Brigham Young?
Wayne Kimball he just retired. He was the professor out there, probably one of the greatest living lithographers in America, helped bring back printmaking in the 60s and 70s.
Uh-huh.
When America was kind of relearning how to do lithography. Europe had a long tradition of lithography, and we kind of didn't know how to do it here. It was a trade-based art form. And so, there are some famous stories about how we were trying to learn lithography in general, but eventually there was a group of artists that emerged from the LA area that, and a lot of them would end up relocating to New Mexico for various reasons. And they just, helped bring back this art form. But Wayne Kimball was one of the early printmakers that, he wasn't in that original guard, but I believe he learned from some of those individuals. And he was teaching at BYU. And, I didn't drink. I was just kind of like a crazy art kid. And my professors thought that I would do well with Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
And, as a naive kid, I kind of thought, BYU is, of course, a Mormon school.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not LDS at all, but, you know, I was just kind of a dumb kid. I really thought, you know, Notre Dame's a great school. It's a Catholic university. There are tons of people that aren't Catholic that go there. I thought the same thing at BYU. So,
and I gather maybe that was not quite your experience there.
No, it was not. I was the only non-member that I had met. There was one faculty member in ceramics that was not a member of the church, and me.
Did that ever cause any serious problems?
Absolutely not.
Okay. No. Everybody accepted you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I had a lot of, I've had a great relationship with them. They've had me back a bunch of times to do talks and do exhibitions. And, you know, it was kind of a really a great experience in a lot of ways. You know, when you're going to a religious university, whether you're a member of that religion or not, or, you know, what have you, I think that, being brought into a family type setting is really great, you know, and so I was kind of looked after in a very pleasant way in grad school. I had a lot of people, you know, making sure things were all right, you know, and, you know, that's
checking on you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I was 22 and I had moved two time zones away from my family, you know, and so people dropping in, making sure everything was all right. You couldn't always get home for the holidays. And so I had, you know, friends in the program that would invite me to these outrageous, massive Thanksgiving celebrations, aww, things like that, you know. And so it was really great to be, you know, a part of that.
So your Master of Fine Arts degree is in printmaking and drawing. You have a minor in art history, but also a minor in phenomenological theory.
Yeah.
What is it? And why? What made you say, this is something I need to know more about?
Well, to be totally honest, the minor is it's art history, but it's focused in the phenomenological studies. So
okay,
I only have
it.
One minor. In case someone decides to write in and say, I know this guy only has one minor.
Some of our listeners are like that, so that was wise of you.
Well, the internet's a wild place, right? But it's one of those things where, and this is really something that led me into doing more gallery work. Phenomenology in some ways is kind of like a deconstructive thought process kind of on steroids. And that also can translate into like spatial studies. And so as I was learning more and more about, you know, phenomenology, it comes up a lot in minimal art theory. And so as you're learning about minimalism with a capital M, it keeps coming up and it's a buzzword. And as you hear a word like that, and you know, and you kind of read through it in an art textbook, and you kind of think, well, what is this? And then, you know, curiosity eventually takes over, and you know, a couple books later, you're still trying to wrap your head around it. It's a very it's something that ended up leading me into gallery work, because it was the study of space. How do we or this take of phenomenology was the study of space. And how do we interact with space? How does space kind of unfold around us? What does that mean? And how does that translate into a viewer experience was the interesting part on my end, because it's a lot of theory that's open-ended and not necessarily about art. It's often about architecture or just the thought process for breaking down ideas.
And I might experience space completely differently than you.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the fun things that I found with phenomenology, is that it can be a completely different experience from one person to the next. Bernard Schumi is a fairly interesting, I believe he was an architecture teacher. Now someone's going to write in. I might have that one wrong. I believe he was an architecture teacher in New York. And he wrote a book called Architecture and Disjunction, but in that there's a chapter called Questions of Space. And I want to say it's about 60-ish questions that are open-ended about how do you interact with space, How do you relate with space physically, and what can that then turn into for a viewer experience? And so there will be an open-ended question, what is space? Follow-up question is like, if space has a, does space have a boundary? Next question would be, if space has boundaries, where do they start and end? And so it's an interesting way to start to break down how we think about space, how we interact with that space, how do we interact with objects. And it's a great almost diagram for understanding what phenomenology is.
It sounds like a great framework for organizing a gallery show around, too.
It really is. And I, when I was younger, I was guilty of leaning on the theory too much. The show is about the theory. Mm-hmm. And really, I feel that that's a waste of everyone's time. The theory's been written. Why would we make art about the theory? So trying to use that theory as a device to help viewers understand what you're doing, or help them interact with a piece in a better or more interesting way, I think that's a better use of theory as opposed to leaning on it almost as a crutch, you know. And that's what I found that I was kind of doing earlier on when I was curating some things.
So it's not the art itself, it's the context for the art.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when I've been making things, I mean, I was obviously quite guilty of that when I was younger, making it about the theory. And the concept was there, but it's kind of like pushed in at the end. It ended up being more about the theory, unfortunately. And so I find that that's just not nearly as interesting of a way of thinking through things.
So in your own art, you have these, at least based on what I saw in your online portfolio, these two very different directions you go. Your drawings are, many of them look like they could be from two or three centuries ago. And I mean that as a compliment. They're beautifully complex, beautiful perspective. And then your installation art is something completely different. Are you channeling two different parts of your personality as you go in those different directions?
Oddly, if it's one of those things where when you see it all together, I used to teach professional practices, and so now I'm very guilty of something that I'd always rail on students about, and that is not having enough information up for people to understand what in the heck it is that they're looking at. So I'm very guilty of that, admittedly, but it's all about history. And so my dad taught U.S. history for 33 years. Mm. And so, you know, whenever we would drive anywhere, we drove to Disney World in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every time we'd pull over, he's like, oh, this is a Civil War battlefield. And he'd get all pumped up and fired up and kind of point here, point there, this happened there. It's just an open field. I thought there would be like cannons and guns laying around, just a mowed, beautiful field.
Yeah.
So, but I know that really kind of entered into my thought process. But the work all is historical in different ways. And I think that some of the drawings that you're referring to, they are typographic ornamentation. That, yes, would have been from 200 or 300 years ago. A lot of it's French. But I found a lot of that typographic ornamentation to be quite sad, and not overtly sad, but kind of have a vein of melancholy running through it. And banners that should have been filled with advertisements and things like that are left, you know, kind of open and empty. And so there are these, like, well-rendered drawings. They're quite large, sometimes 30 by 40.
Wow.
And I think some people that are listening might think that not a very impressive drawing, but if you saw how uptight I am with the way I draw them, they're fairly large. And then, frankly, they're painted horribly. I'll go back in with like colored Bombay ink and paint them in a very slap and dash kind of manner. And I think that that's kind of a pathetic maneuver that if people kind of think it through, it is a very sad thing to do. You're wasting this beautiful drawing by slapping all of this ink in such a, frankly, lame way onto the surface. And when you start putting that together in these empty banners, I think that that, you know, again, that vein of melancholy kind of runs through it. But the installations are also based in historical kind of motifs. And so there's one exhibition, The Strawberry Thief, which is on my site, and it's a two-person exhibition I did with a great artist, Bill Conger, from Illinois. And it's kind of based on the pattern Strawberry Thief. And we were kind of thinking one day, you know, what, simply put, what if this was the ultimate, this really beautiful pattern, you know, with these birds kind of fighting over these strawberries, you know. What if that was kind of the ultimate moment in art? What if that's not passable, right, on some level? And so we started kind of thinking about building a show around that. And we started kind of thinking about this idea of the pathetic and maybe just this open-ended idea of kind of like an impotent moment that doesn't really ever, you know, go anywhere or take off. And what that led to was an exhibition we did at Hellmuth Projects in San Diego. And in that, I recreated moonlight accurately. And so the lighting inside the exhibition is the same lux level as moonlight, which is about one lux. And when lighting is that low, something kicks in your rods and cones. So you're, I think in the dark, we all know things kind of look black and white.
Sure.
As you really adjust, your blue cones can be activated again. And I kind of think of it as like a very lame predator vision, right?
Sure.
From the 80s movie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so things actually start to show up in some shades of gray and blue to kind of help you see. And it was this kind of, you know, evolutionary, you know, adaptation that we had to be able to, I think, run from things in the moonlight, probably less than hunt things in the moonlight.
Sure.
And there have been some studies as to why, you know, paintings of night scenes were in blue, because we don't actually... When nightscapes are photographed, they're not really in blue. They're just kind of in a weird, you know, toned-down color scheme. So as they started to study that, they discovered, of course, that we do see in a slightly blue tint. So like Van Gogh's Starry Night, having that blue background and the blue, you know, cityscape kind of around it, or landscape around it, rather, it's accurate for the viewer experience. And so I wanted to recreate that in a gallery setting. And so then we went and I found some Strawberry Thief wallpaper that was blue on blue, which is kind of, it was really beautiful, but it's kind of sad. It was never made as a wallpaper. It was always a textile pattern. And so, you know, the blue on blue kind of ruins it also, right? But it wouldn't have mattered because you're seeing it in this moonlight. Bill curated this really interesting group of objects on a small pedestal that wouldn't matter what they looked like. They were all black, and so you had these kind of sad things also that were kind of gone. So he had like an actual megalodon tooth, which is, it was black. There's a solar cell, which is rendered useless, you know, in the dark, you know, some things like that. And so I think there was a nice kind of poetic, like, sadness to it, but they were in a very beautiful setting.
Sharon Gamble with Colin Nesbitt, new director of the Heron School of Art and Design Gallery. You can learn more about the gallery and about Colin at heron.iupui.edu. Again, that's heron.iupui.edu.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. A Craftsman's Legacy is a new show airing on WFYI 3, our sister TV station, and it features motorcycle builder Eric Gorgias apprenticing with a different craftsperson each week to learn about their work. Travis DiNicola spoke with host Gorgias by phone to see what he's learned.
Eric, thanks so much for being on Art of the Matter. Great to have a chance to chat with you.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. I'm really curious about this because it's this show, Craftsman's Legacy, I mean, really cool stuff you're doing and that you get to do because of the show. How'd you decide to go about putting the show together? I mean, you're a motorcycle builder.
I am. You know, I build custom motorcycles for a living, but I'm a sheet metal shaper. Mm-hmm. So what that means is I make compound surfaces in metal, so fuel tanks and fenders and things like that. But in my travels, I had an opportunity to meet different craftsmen and work with different craftsmen. And probably about 5 years ago or so, I thought, mm-hmm. you know, this would make a great TV show introducing these craftsmen stories to everybody.
Yeah.
And that's when we started working on it, you know, and it just took a long time to put it all together, but
That's pretty awesome. I mean what I really like about the show the most is in each one you really are an apprentice to whoever these master craftsmen are, and whether you're you know, learning how to blow glass or build a guitar or whatever it may be, in the course of that, I mean, you know, there's definitely been some challenges. What's the hardest one for you that has come up so far? I mean, in terms of where you're going, man, those guys are amazing.
You know, I think working with every single craftsman, I had that feeling like, yeah. Holy cow, you guys are just amazing people, right? Because, you know, when you're good at something, you make it look easy to other people because you've done it 1,000 times, literally.
Sure.
One of the harder things for me probably was working with the ceramics with the potter.
Oh, really?
Because, because, you know, I didn't really have any experience with it at all, and my hands are used to working with metal.
Right. I mean, I could see, like, maybe the guitar or the gunmaker or blacksmith, that may be a little bit closer to what you're used to, or, I mean, just in terms of materials, right?
I mean, definitely the blacksmith and knife maker and the goldsmith and things like that. That was a little bit easier for me. Even the glass is really difficult to work with because you're using gravity all the time, mm-hmm. you know. I had a great time. I mean, honestly, there isn't one thing I did that I didn't thoroughly enjoy doing and learning about, you know. It's just so much information. It's really cool.
That's really cool. It's funny though. I'm you know, a little surprised that you mentioned the potter, ceramicist. I mean, you hear a lot of the time how difficult it is to work with, like, pottery on a wheel, clay on a wheel, if you're not used to that. Was that part of it for you? I mean, just sort of learning.
No,
that,
it wasn't even. We weren't even on a wheel.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, and it wasn't that it was so difficult. It was
just different.
You know, trying to keep it all symmetrical, trying to keep everything moving, you know, keeping the right water consistency and moisture in it, and you know, it was that type of thing, and it was really just sort of a learning curve for me, you know.
So were there any that, because of your skills, you know, with metal and stuff, that you just kind of immediately slipped into, like, oh yeah, now I know exactly what I'm doing here?
Oh yeah, the working with you know, the blacksmith or the bladesmith, it was just an extension of what I do now, so it was very familiar, but it was still a ton of fun. You know, I mean, it was awesome. I got to work with some huge power hammers that I had never had exposure to before. So that was really cool, you know?
Nice. That's awesome. So any of these that, you know, you could see yourself, you know, continuing to do in the future, you know, is...
you know, let's see. I went and worked with a saddle maker in Georgia for a while, mm-hmm. and then when I came home, I sort of continued on and expanded my leatherworking skills, and you know,
yeah,
I think everybody's going to get some kind of belt or cuff link for Christmas this year.
Nice.
you know, the knife making and, you know, different things like that, for sure. I really enjoyed it. I mean, it was just a blast.
So why is this so important? I mean, to share these skills and these stories of these craftsmen and their craft. Why is it so important to you?
For me, it's important because I think a lot of people have sort of lost touch with that anymore. You know, we live in a time where it's nice, you can get things immediately, and mm-hmm. and we've lost that patience and that understanding of waiting for things, but also what it takes to make something.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we don't even think of that anymore. Like, I mean, if you were to get a card for somebody in your family, you know, nobody thinks twice about going to the store and making or buying one, but
sure, right.
Nobody ever really thinks about making one anymore unless you're a kid, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And but it's the ones that are handmade that are kept.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And absolutely. Those are the ones that everybody cherishes. So I think there's more things like that in life, and we sort of need to find our way back to that.
So so what's next for you? I mean, you've done this season. Are you planning to do more of these? Is there another craft out there that you'd really like to experience?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're just sort of planning out season two right now, and,
yeah.
And you know, hopefully we'll be back out shooting that shortly, you know. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of these people that I'd like to, you know, share their life stories with, because
mm-hmm.
I think they're just amazing life stories and very inspiring, you know.
How are you finding these people? I mean, you know, is it, I mean, by, you know, searching on the internet or word of mouth? Or
some of it's word of mouth, some of it's searching on the internet and going through casting and just talking to them and, you know, feeling them out a little bit. And the reputation of their work speaks loudly for most people.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So any you know, people are watching this show here on WFYI TV, and you know, we're in having the first series run here, and we'll have more information about that in just a moment. But you know, as people are watching it, are there any let's say maybe some outtakes that didn't make it on the air of some maybe some interesting outcomes or disasters or anything that you want to share behind the scenes?
You know, there's a ton of outtakes and just, you know, basically me goofing up that,
uh-huh.
you know, didn't always make it and always make the cut. Some of them we're going to put up online.
Cool.
You know, on our website and share that with people. I mean, I remember I worked with the guitar maker,
mm-hmm.
and he was an amazing craftsman and very fast. And he had these rope clamps that he used to put pressure on pieces while they were being glued up.
Okay.
And seeing him do it, it looked really fast and really easy, like tying your shoe.
Yeah.
It took me like forever and a day to figure out how to do it. And I never got it right. He always had to come back and correct it. And I, you know, I was like this close to hanging myself with the thing because I just couldn't figure it out. But none of that made it in the
yeah.
actual show. We'll have to put it up online because it's sort of funny.
Absolutely. Hey, one last question for you, Eric.
Yeah.
I'm really, really curious about the work that you do as a, you know, as a custom motorcycle builder. And I mean, is any of what you're learning or experiencing from Craftsman's Legacy going to make it into some of the bikes? I mean, you mentioned, you know, that you've been doing some of the leather work, and you know, I just started picturing like, okay, like a really cool leather saddle, you know, on one of your bikes or something like that. Or, you know, I mean, do you ever foresee that happening?
You know, I don't know if any of that stuff would ever directly make it into one of my bikes, you know, but overall, just working with different materials and expanding my knowledge and becoming a better craftsman overall,
mm-hmm.
you know, definitely feeds back to my work as a metal shaper and, you know.
Excellent. Eric, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you, man. Thanks a lot for taking the time today.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the call. I enjoyed it.
Travis DiNicola with a Craftsman's Legacy host, Eric Gorgeous. You can watch a Craftsman's Legacy every Wednesday night at 8:30 on WFYI 3. You can also learn more at craftsmanslegacy.com, craftsmanslegacy.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Time is growing short.
Oh, yes, it is. The year is coming to a close.
The year is coming to a close. And think back to your, what are those called? New Year's resolutions
oh, yeah,
from
yeah.
last year. And if you vowed you were going to get to some new concert or some new kind of art exhibit or whatever, you're running out of weeks this year.
Yep.
This is the time. We also have some suggestions for things that might make good holiday presents for Christmas or Hanukkah on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
Well,
you know, the main thing I'm thinking about right now is I mean, of course, Christmas and all that, but New Year's Eve, making New Year's Eve plans. Got to get those in soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a great place to celebrate the new year would be at the IMA. They're doing what's called the Big Reveal, New Year's Eve at the IMA, and they have different packages available that include champagne and cocktails and lots of live entertainment. I know that DJ Kyle Long is going to be performing, as well as the Impalas, and I've seen the list of the food stations, which are incredible. Everything from Mexican and Chinese and Middle Eastern and Indian and all sorts of great food that's going to be there, and lots of fun stuff. The gallery is going to be open, so you know you can check out Georgia O'Keeffe. You just can't take your cocktail in there. And there's going to even be like an outdoor party area and some special rooms in the different galleries that you can sort of sneak away to enjoy. You can get all the information, of course, at imamuseum.org and check out New Year's Eve at the IMA. It should be a lot of fun this year.
Fun and festive indeed. Love it. Hey, you might still be able to score a ticket to Elf, the Broadway musical playing at the Old National Center through this Saturday. Tickets are on sale, but you probably want to track those down pretty quickly. If you go to BroadwayInIndianapolis.com, you can find out what they did to that one of everybody's top 10 Christmas movies as they transported it to the stage and made it into a charming musical.
And very fun stuff. And Mark Fishbeck, a local actor, is playing Santa Claus.
Indeed, that's right.
Yeah.
Local boy does good.
Very good. Hey, a beautiful thing to do to spend the afternoon doing would be to go out and check out the Garfield Park Conservatory and Gardens, which
Woo-hoo!
Is open till 5 pretty much every day. Yeah, because they have Conservatory Crossing now through December 31st, where they've decked out the conservatory with lots of poinsettias and model trains and train villages and lots of lights, and it's just beautiful there, and always a very fun thing to see. It's only $3 per person or $8 per family, thanks to Indy Parks, and again, it's open pretty much every day until 5, now through the end of the year at Garfield Park.
Fantastic. If you and maybe somebody in your family enjoys visual art, you might want to head up to Gallery 2 at 5912 North College Avenue, basically 59th and College, next to Binkley's across from Ambrosia, if you can picture that intersection. There's an exhibit called Yuletide Magic right now, 60 seasonal works by some of the best Indiana painters in oil, pastel, and acrylic. A lot of beautiful oil works there. That shows up through December 27th, and most of the works are for sale. Some of them have been purchased already, of course, but you can also check out the other side of the gallery, which has historic paintings by great Indiana artists, as well as some really groovy rugs. So you can do a lot of shopping in that one little location at 59th and College.
There you go. Hey, if you've not seen the Velveteen Rabbit yet at the IRT, well, this weekend is the last weekend to see it. And not only can you see it this weekend, but they are bringing in some special furry friends, some real rabbits for the show. And a Velveteen Lop Rabbit, which is the rabbit weighs about 5 pounds and has very springy hair and ears about 14 inches long.
Whoa.
And it'll be a lot of fun. So they're going to have real rabbits at their production of Velveteen Rabbit this weekend at the IRT. The rabbits are going to be in the lobby 30 minutes before and after the performances on the 20th and 21st.
I'm sorry, stage managers. Back in my Phoenix days, we had a show that featured a rabbit. Well, actually more than one over the years, and Rabbits have a habit of eating paper. So everybody wanted to cuddle the bunny and, you know, give it socialization so that we'd all put it on our desk and a few minutes later discovered that lots of papers on the desk had little bunny nibble marks in them. Aww. So just a word about rabbits. Okay, speaking of critters, Actors Theater of Indiana's Year with Frog and Toad is a wonderful family-oriented show, and it is playing just through this Sunday the 21st. So if you haven't gathered some children, and actually they won't check, you can go if you're just a grown-up and want to relive your childhood. But if you have kids in your life, it's a great opportunity to take them to see a fun professional show through this Sunday.
Well, Sharon, that is all the time we have because we got to do our Christmas shopping, but you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, and we'll be back next week. Oh, it's our Christmas show, so we'll have lots of holiday music.
We'll be back in 2 weeks.
With that calendar we call.
What'll we do?
Of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
What's an Artville? Well, among other things, it's an unusual partnership between Irvington's 5547 Art Project and the Stutz Artists Association. Sharon Gamble invited 5547 Project Gallery owner David Jackson, Gallery Director Amy Warner, and visual artist Benji Ramsey to our studios to learn more about the experiment, which opens on Saturday, January 10th.
So I have a gallery owner, an organizer slash publicist, and an artist in the room. Did I get the... Amy's looking at me like, what is that? Is that an accurate description of my role? Is that an accurate description of your role?
I work at the 5547 Gallery.
All right.
Yes.
And what is your official title?
I'm unsure if I have an official title.
It's a gallery director.
Gallery director. So you do all that and more.
Yeah, and we also put on events. I help coordinate the events there, too.
Awesome.
Yeah.
David, the gallery is yours.
Correct.
And how did you come to have a gallery?
For the little town of Irvington there, I really wanted to create a space the community could use. And that's how it really started off. We do a lot of repurposing, upcycle kind of stuff. And once we got that stuff out there, we really needed something, artists to be put on the walls. And we wanted to make it community friendly, that the kids can come in and meet the artist, and the artist could share what their knowledge with everybody. And that's what we sort of have there.
Mm-hmm. Is 5547 a reference to an address, I'm guessing?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell I used to live in Irvington at 5600 East?
There you go. That's it.
So where is the... I know that that this particular exhibition isn't at your gallery, right?
It's actually at both.
It's shared between the studs.
Yes.
And,
it is.
Oh,
it's
okay.
A partnership. It's a unique event that we're doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So where exactly is the gallery in Irvington?
It's 5547 Bonna Avenue. It's at the location that's going to be the coal factory come next summer.
Oh, okay. Got it. And for anybody who's not familiar yet, explain what the coal factory is.
The coal factory is the old foam craft building. It was built way back in the 40s, about 40,000 square feet of warehouse space. Blackacre Brewery, Justin Miller, went out with some developers, and they bought it, and they're turning it into something fantastic over on the east side.
Kind of a place to hang, to go get a microbrew, to do lots of... There's going to be a lot of
There's a very
space.
High-end restaurant coming in,
yeah.
Poe's B-Boy, or B's Po'Boys coming in.
Mm.
B's Coffee Roasters is going to be in there. So there's a lot of different elements that's going to be moving in, all artisan in nature.
And your gallery will still be there?
Yes, we have a gallery and coffee shop there.
Great. And so I understand where your gallery is. How did you get in the gallery business?
It was developed over time. It's an interesting story. The main business is to go out and clean the streets of Indianapolis. That's how it was all funded. And by cleaning up the city, we started bringing stuff back, and we started making things out of it. People started buying it, accent walls, tables, chairs, lights, all from refuge we found on the city streets.
Wow.
And then I introduced it to the artist, and they said, hey, can we show here? And we said, yeah. And then that got the gallery side going. The coffee shop came because we wanted to open it up more. We didn't want a 2-3 hours a month gallery. So we are open 7 days a week, pretty much 12 hours a day.
Wow. Sounds exhausting.
It is.
Amy, as gallery director, there's a laugh of recognition in that, right?
It's fun, though. You don't think about the hours. You think about everything that you're doing for the local art scene and the musicians and the comedians and the storytellers. So it's I appreciate the coffee being there because it's not a strict time of we're only open on First Friday. And the staff, the baristas are amazing. They're actually local celebrities themselves. So it's a nice combination.
How long have you been up and running now?
It's been a couple of years now. The coffee shop used to only be open for the first and third Friday. And that's when we said, you know what, this is crazy. Let's open the doors. Let's let the community in every day. And that's what we did.
That's ambitious. That's a big, big job you got there.
Yes, we run, 20, 30 artists through a month. So Every month you get to see 20 new artists.
Yeah.
And that's not even including the comedians, the musicians. We have so much talent there in Irvington and surrounding areas in Indianapolis. It's just an amazing place to go visit.
Benji, how'd you get hooked up with these guys? How'd you find out about them?
Well, luckily, someone gave Amy one of my cards, and she decided to contact me, and I showed her some of my art and went from there. I was in First Fridays last month at the gallery, and it's kind of opened my eyes to a whole new world here in the city. Usually I do graphic designing, web designing. I am a touring VJ, which I do the video screens behind concerts and fashion shows and things like that.
How'd you get started with that specialty?
Went to a concert of a couple electronic groups, the Chemical Brothers and the Orb, back in 97. Uh-huh. And it really just kind of blew me away. They had video screens where the visuals were in sync with the music. And so when something would go down to an interlude, per se, there was one example where a cow wandered onto the screen and started mooing and had McDonald's symbols all over it.
Ooh.
And then as soon as that happened, a song started going, and it was created with sampled sounds of a cow. So every time the cow's mouth would move, the music started going to his mouth.
Wow.
It was really neat. So at this time, I was playing football in college. I got injured and transferred schools back down to SIU in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And changed my major from physical education to radio and television. So I learned how to do video editing. I was in an audio production major. And once the technology to do the video mixing live with a laptop started coming into play, I got into it, built my own video projector out of a bunch of plans online, using a bunch of junk, and started doing some shows out at a club in town called The Mirage, which a friend of mine owned on Thursday night when no one was there. And right people came out, saw me, and booked me in Chicago, bought some real projectors, and it went from there.
Wow. I want to go back up to a phrase you used a moment ago. Doing this live, how much, when you're doing a concert, when you're doing these visuals, these graphics for a concert, how much do you know about the set list beforehand? How much of it is planned out beforehand, and how much of it is on the fly?
I know absolutely nothing.
So it's all...
Everything that I do is I listen to the music, and then I interpret it, and then with what I have of my massive gigabyte catalog of information and data files, mix those different sources and make what I think would go along with the music.
That's a lot of resources to muster in an impromptu basis.
Yes.
Have you ever been thrown a loop or ever been stuck and thought, I don't know what to do here?
No, I haven't.
Wow. What's the hardest thing about doing that?
The setup and takedown. Usually it's the takedown because I go in and build a video installation. So I spend 9 hours building pretty much this humongous multi, sometimes 9 projectors video installation. And then I play, perform that night, and then when everybody else is gone, I'm still tearing down.
Mm. We need to get you some roadies.
Yeah. But with the nature of the equipment, I don't trust anybody else.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
So it's usually me.
Have you been able to do this at the this gallery space yet?
I have not, but I will be doing it at the Stutz.
Okay. So how did this partnership with the Stutz come into being? Everybody's looking at Amy.
Yeah. I was it's been about 6 weeks ago, introduced by Vaughn Biggs, who will actually be one of the artists that will be showing at the Stutz on January 10th. Mm-hmm. And he introduced me to Lee and Martha and one of their volunteers to put on a show. Mm-hmm. They gave me January. And since we typically at 5547 Project, we have a First Friday show. It lands on the 2nd. I just thought that wasn't going to be productive for anyone.
Sure.
Also, being an artist, the Stutz show it's a juried show. We can only allow 40 artists, but I knew I was going to get a slew of submissions. And being an artist myself, I've gone through that rejection process before. So this seemed like a creative idea to have kind of a dual event. We're going to have the 40 artists at the Stutz, and then we'll also have 25-30 artists there at the 5547. We're going to provide free transportation to and from that evening. I think it's going to be great. It's going to be
fun.
Different and unique, and this way everyone gets an opportunity to show.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. Where'd the name Artville come from?
There's a gentleman named Coleman Love. He was actually one of the featured artists at the 5547 Project. That's how I came in contact with him. He had this graphic of a picture that he's a photographer, and he manipulated it, and it looks like a circle, and it's all the buildings downtown, and the name just jumped out. This is after 5 hours one night with a friend, with a couple of people, going back, like, you know, what do you call this? And I saw that image and said the word Artville, and it is true in the sense that in the world of art, it really does take a village. It takes everyone coming together to make it a big event, B, for art sales, and to have a good time. And so it seemed fitting.
Love it. Very fun. And it's becoming more and more true of Indianapolis. This has become a place where there is more art activity by the week.
By the week.
By the week. It's crazy good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When I first started back in 07, 08 as an artist, there wasn't a lot of things to get involved in. Or there was, but again, it was a juried selection, or you had to know certain people. There was a hard hill to climb, and I think that there's all kinds of different opportunities for all kinds of different artists in every level and every skill set now.
What do you work in when you're practicing your art?
What's my medium? Mm-hmm. I do a lot of abstract on canvas. I'm a painter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Benji, you've already illustrated that you use a lot of different tools. What will you be doing for this particular show?
Some of the art that I've got in the show is plaster and fiberglass. And what I do with that is I find a lot of what I find kind of like architecture in you know, refuse or garbage. I'll find different molds where I will see, wow, that would look like a good cast, and I will cast plaster in that, but then I will finish it to look like metal.
Hmm.
His work looks like metal when you visibly look at it, and when you before you touch it, because it's hard not to say what.
Yeah,
what are
we
looking at?
Usually I take take that, though, and then before I'll build a frame, and then I encase LED lighting in the frame, so then that will light up the fiberglass resin around it to give it a glow, and then a glow will also protrude around the wall.
Wow. David, Mr. Gallery owner, are you a hands-on artist as well?
I wouldn't call it art. What we do is make things, accent walls. We sort of put the vision there.
Say more about that.
We find stuff and turn it into a wall, an accent wall.
Yeah.
Last year we took a tree off of a daycare center and brought the tree back, and it happened to be extremely straight. So we cut it up in all these little pieces and made an accent wall off of it, a beautiful wall to hang art off of. So we're sort of the art behind the art.
Gee, I just had a vision of your friends knowing you were coming to dinner and saying, "Stay out of our trash." Because, you know, I recycle a lot of stuff myself, and, you know, it's hard to stay away from those alleys where people discard things, and, you know, but hey.
That's it.
Got to give things a new life.
Yes, you do.
Well, Break a Leg, I hope this is just the first of many collaborations with the Stutz and with other galleries as well. You get back in your studio.
I will.
Both of you, back in your studio.
Sharon Gamble with 5547 Project Gallery owner David Jackson, gallery director Amy Warner, and visual artist Benji Ramsey. Artville opens on January 10th from 7 to 11 at the Raymond James Art Gallery at the Stutz Building and also at the 5547 Project Gallery at 5547 Bonna Avenue in Irvington. The free opening is family-friendly with music, food, and drink. The exhibit continues through January 30th. You can learn more by searching for 5547 Project on Facebook. Again, 5547. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday, that's Christmas, at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when we'll have our annual holiday show.
There will be lots of carols from local musicians and a few surprises for your stocking.
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.